Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. Our guest for the hour this week is Juan Gonzalez. Juan is one of the country's best-known Latino journalists. He was a staff columnist for New York's Daily News from 1987 to 2016, and he's been a co-host with Amy Goodman, my sister, since 1996 of Democracy Now! He's now a professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers. He's the author of a number of books, including Harvest of Empire, News for All the People, and Fallout. He was born in Puerto Rico and raised in New York City. His newest book is Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. Juan Gonzalez, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Let's start with your new book. What is America's Tale of Two Cities?
Well, the Tale of Two Cities, as first, formulated by Bill de Blasio when he ran in 2013 for mayor of New York, was that that the city of New York, like many urban areas around the country, was actually two cities, a city where the wealthy and the affluent were able to find good jobs, good housing, and a much better quality of life. And then there was the other city, where as many as half of the population was still in poverty, where the neighborhoods were run down, where city services were not being properly dispensed. And so he vowed to end this tale of two cities if he was elected mayor when he ran in 2013. And of course, he was running in the period right after the Great Recession, right after the Occupy Wall Street movement made wealth inequality a national topic of conversation and really made the We Are the 99% a slogan known throughout the country and really around the world, so that he tapped into, at that moment, a feeling that many Americans felt, that somehow or other government and the elites of the country had left most of the nation behind.
You set the scene about explaining who Bill de Blasio is, because you need to explain who Bill de Blasio is to a national audience. He was not a well-known figure outside of New York, and really not even in New York City up until that election. And you set the scene by describing his inauguration, the actual day of it. Explain what happened.
Well, inaugurations of mayors in New York, like in any city around the country, are usually just local affairs. And New York City being the nation's biggest city, there's usually much more press than at other city inaugurations. But this one was in the dead of winter, New Year's Day of 2014, several thousand people, and it was an extremely cold day. And here suddenly comes, not in a limousine or in a set of SUVs, but suddenly the new mayor-elect and his wife and two teenage children come out of the subway, the local subway station, where they'd taken a subway ride from their home in Brooklyn, and suddenly appear and walk into the City Hall courtyard area where the inauguration is being held, and where all of the dignitaries, including a former president, Bill Clinton, a would-be president at the time, Hillary Clinton, and the governor of the state, the former mayor, Bloomberg, a variety of other dignitaries, ambassadors, and were waiting for him to arrive. So just, I think, the way he entered to his inauguration was sending a signal that this was a mayor who was not only committed on the campaign trail, but would attempt in his reforms and his policies to really address the ordinary New York City residents, those who have been taking the subway to work for more than a century now. It's been a part of the rite of passage of all workers in New York City. You take the subway to go to work.
So explain who Bill de Blasio is and what his political lineage was that led to Gracie Mansion, the mayor's residence.
Well, de Blasio actually has a history, both not only his a personal history, but the history of his family as one that has always inclined toward social activism. His his father and mother, Warren Wilhelm and Anna de Blasio Wilhelm, were both sort of products of the New Deal. They were big supporters of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They both went to elite colleges, Sheeta Ratcliffe and the father to Yale. And both got sort of, especially his mother, was very involved in the progressive movement of the late 1940s, was a big supporter of the Wallace presidential candidacy in 1948, and also was a and both ended up being blacklisted during the McCarthy era, accused of being communists, and not able to get government jobs. So that the result was the father, Warren Wilhelm, became very bitter, became an alcoholic since he had been a World War II hero, and he came back from World War II and was suddenly being accused of being a communist. And he ended up descending into alcoholism and eventually killing himself when Bill de Blasio was a teenager, shooting himself in the chest with a shotgun. And his mother, however, maintained her social activism and was a housing organizer and continued to support her sons when they all became turned against the Vietnam War. And Bill de Blasio, as a result, ended up more being nurtured by his mother and becoming more of a social activist himself. He eventually was not only active as a student at NYU, he eventually became a big supporter of the Nicaraguan Sandinista government and worked with the Quixote Center, a liberal group that organized support among Americans here for the revolutions in El Salvador and in Nicaragua. And he worked, actually went to Nicaragua for a period of time. So he was basically a young radical leftist until in the late 1980s he gets recruited into the campaign of David Dinkins for mayor. And becomes a low-level aide to Bill Lynch, who was the mastermind of the Dinkins victory in 1989 as the first African American mayor of the city of New York. So de Blasio then becomes sort of a low-level aide in the Dinkins administration, working in community relations, and gets his first taste of politics that way. During that time, his mother actually writes a book that he encouraged her to write, on the Italian resistance fighters, the socialists and the communists and the anti-fascists that sought to foment armed resistance against fascism within Italy, and she credits her son with encouraging her to do this book. So he really comes from sort of not a red diaper baby, but certainly a pink diaper baby in terms of his lineage and his outlook on life.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and we're spending the hour this week with the legendary journalist Juan Gonzalez, a columnist for some 30 years with the New York Daily News, co-host for 20 years of Democracy Now!, and the author of a number of books, including his newest, Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. So Bill de Blasio runs for mayor in 2013. This is the race to replace Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a billionaire who also followed Rudy Giuliani. These are not progressive leaders of America's largest city. How does de Blasio find his opening? There are some well-known people running for mayor in 2013. He's not one of them.
No, he was considered least likely to succeed of all the people on the Democratic side running for mayor at the time because you had much more well-known figures. You had the Speaker of the New York City Council, Christine Quinn, who was running. You had a former city comptroller, Bill Thompson, who had run against Bloomberg previously and had actually performed much better than anyone expected, even though he lost. There was the infamous Anthony Weiner, who wasn't quite as infamous then, who was actually a pretty popular congressman at the time. And there was the sitting controller, John Liu, who was arguably the most radical of the bunch, even more than de Blasio, and who had lots of campaign money that he'd squirreled away, but who was under the cloud of a federal investigation into possible campaign finance violations. So Liu was crippled by that. So, and then there was de Blasio, the one who no one expected, the public advocate who was virtually unknown in the city, and who no one expected to be able to overcome these other rivals that he was facing. But the problem was that, and I think the point of my book is that it's not just important that de Blasio was able to come from behind to achieve this victory, but that the year 2013 really marked the coming of age of an entire generation of progressive municipal leaders in the country, of which de Blasio was the most, turned out to be, because he won in the largest city in the country and in the center of world capitalism. He won on a campaign of ending income inequality and ending police abuse of African-American and Latino citizens and ending the affordable housing crisis. Those were the pillars of his campaign, in addition to a whole new approach to resolving public education, which was to create universal pre-kindergarten programs, to extend the school year for everyone, and thereby, in the long term, raise the educational level of all the children of New York. So his victory alone is remarkable. But I think the point that I try to make in the book is that it was much bigger than that. What was happening and what it continues to happen to this day is that the cities of America have become the base areas and the only hope for progressive change in the country, the local governments, because at the current climate, the federal government has abandoned the cities, is gridlocked, and is in control of extreme right-wing Republican elements. Most of the state governments are in similar situation where, and so that, therefore, the only hope for political change is at the local level, at the urban level, and that's where most of the people are. The reality is that regardless of how the electoral map has been gerrymandered, the reality is the vast number of Americans today live in cities. So therefore, how these cities are governed, and the point I make in the book, it's a worldwide situation. Within 20 years, 70% of all the people on the planet Earth will live in cities. Therefore, as more and more people leave the countryside and gravitate to the urban centers of the world, the issue of how these cities are run becomes primary. And what the de Blasio movement and what the other progressive mayors that are similar to him, some more radical than de Blasio, some less radical. I give examples of Gail McLaughlin in Richmond, California, and her group, the Richmond Progressive Alliance, Chakwa Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi, Roz Baraka in Newark, New Jersey, Bill Peduto in Pittsburgh, and Betsy Hodges in Minneapolis. Martin Walsh is among the more from Boston, is among the more conservative of the progressive mayors. So I don't even think that de Blasio is the most radical. I certainly think that Gail McLaughlin, Chakwa Lumumba, and his son, we have to see, his son just got reelected in Jackson, whether he'll continue in his father's footsteps. And Roz Baraka are certainly more accomplishing more than even de Blasio is to a certain extent. However, because de Blasio presides over a colossus. New York City government is a colossus. 300,000 people work for the city of New York. Directly, there's tens of thousands of others that work in other agencies, but 300,000 people work for the city of New York. And it had a budget of $70 billion annually when de Blasio came in. I think the budget now is up to about $85 billion. It is an enormous administrative apparatus. And the idea that it is now under the control of a relatively progressive alliance is a shocking state of affairs for the elite of New York and the elite of the country. And so as I chronicle in the book, since de Blasio got elected, there's been $20 million spent in television advertisements by landlord groups, by charter school proponents, by Uber and the other, you know, developing companies of the sharing economy to try to tar and feather Bill de Blasio. You cannot turn on a television in New York City on a weekday night without seeing ads blasting de Blasio.
And we should point out de Blasio is up for election this year.
Right, he's up for re-election. So are all of these folks. That are, most of the ones that I talked about were elected in 2013. In all of these cities now, this whole crop of mayor, but it's not just mayors, it's city council members. Many young people started running for city council in the mid-2000s and the late, and now are in office. And they are having a dramatic effect on the policies that are being adopted by city councils in Denver, Colorado, in Baltimore, in Austin, Texas, in Minneapolis, in Seattle. All of these cities have these new groups of young people that have now run for office, are in positions now where they can actually formulate progressive policy. And I think it's a very hopeful sign. And most of them came to power as a result of grassroots movements.
So explain, 2013, many of these mayors, from de Blasio to Walsh and others, are elected. What came together? Why 2013?
Well, I think it started earlier, and as I document in the book, it really started in the late 90s and early 2000s, when the first group of really progressive folks started winning election to city council races. I talk about Nick Licata in Seattle, who waged a fierce campaign against Seattle city government subsidizing sports stadiums and was responsible for the Seattle Supersonics eventually leaving Seattle and becoming the Oklahoma City Thunder because they couldn't get the arena they wanted because Licata wouldn't give it to them and was able to mount a progressive group to prevent them from being able to get another subsidized arena because they had had previous subsidized arena. Same thing with Betsy Hodges. She was battling subsidies for the Minnesota Vikings stadium. So a lot of these folks began in grassroots campaigns, usually backed by affordable housing groups, by groups opposed to subsidies for developers. And as I point out in the book, more than a few of those early victories came as a result of work done by an organization that was almost forgotten now these days, ACORN. ACORN was, for a period of time in the United States, the most influential poor people's organization in the country. It had close to about 500,000 members. It had hundreds of chapters all around the country. It was an in-the-face organization that kept registering people to vote and demonstrating against banks and insurance companies, and was actually beginning to build alliances with labor unions to begin to develop independent Democrats or a complete independent political groupings. However, by 2008, the right wing in America realized that ACORN had to be stopped, and they were helped by the fact that ACORN's leaders, some of the leaders engaged in terrible financial improprieties with their money, and then because of these infamous videos, supposedly of Acorn organizations that were receiving federal funds, agreeing to support fraudulent applications for federal funds by people. It was actually a setup job by James O'Keefe. And then that triggered federal investigations. There were charges that Acorn was engaging in voter registration fraud. All of this ended up crippling Acorn. And by 2010, Acorn is disbanded. However, it was disbanded and many of the leaders of Acorn then formed their own new organizations throughout the country. And you will find that many of the progressive officials that have come to power came to power through through the work of those former Acorn activists. Bill de Blasio's organization is filled with former Acorn people. Emma Wolf, his chief advisor, was an Acorn organizer. So Acorn had built the organizational grassroots movement that helped propel many of these leaders to power.
You describe in the book that one of the things that de Blasio and these other progressive mayors took on was the urban growth machine. What is that?
You know, well, I take that moniker from a wonderful book written a few decades ago by John Logan, Harvey Mahler, sociologist. The book is called Urban Fortunes, The Political Economy of Place. And it is a study of how is urban policy formulated. And Malish and Logan, their theory is that urban America has been dominated by a growth machine for decades, which is a lot of coalitions of bankers and real estate people and financiers in various cities around the country who believe that cities grow when commercial and luxury development is incentivized, and that the best use of a city's land is the use that is most profitable to the development community, and so the growth machine believes that's how you promote urban growth, but Logan and Malish says that vision has always been in conflict with the use model of the residents of a city. Residents of a city see the space, the land in their city as something that should be helping their quality of life. Public parks, public schools, the use of the streets. And so there's a constant battle in cities across America, it has been for more than a century, between the proponents of the growth machine and the proponents of the use model of what the land should be used for in a city. And what I conclude is, as I study some of the literature on this, is that this growth machine has gone through a variety of phases now for the last 80 to 100 years. It started out as a really conservative group of leaders, extremely class biased and racist in their policies. So the original zoning laws in the United States were really, that began to be developed in the early 1900s, were meant to zone neighborhoods not only to bring order to cities, but to keep what the proponents used to call inharmonious racial groups out of certain neighborhoods. So zoning became a tool of the growth machine to limit African Americans and Latinos to a particular neighborhood. But the growth machine then has gone through other iterations.
We're going to take a break there. We're talking with Juan Gonzalez, the longtime columnist of the New York Daily News, co-host of Democracy Now!, and author of the new book, Reclaiming Gotham. We'll be back just after the news. This is the Vermont Conversation. Stay tuned.